From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration has announced its plan to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. DACA has offered legal protection to young people who came to the U.S. illegally, granting them work permits and shielding them from deportation. Roughly 800,000 people are DACA recipients. Attorney General Jeff Sessions made the announcement today at the Justice Department, calling DACA unconstitutional.
The policy was implemented unilaterally to great controversy and legal concern after Congress rejected legislative proposals to extend similar benefits on numerous occasions to this same group of illegal aliens. In other words, the executive branch, through DACA, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. And Scott, tell us more about what the attorney general said.
Well, he said the administration was facing a threat of lawsuit, legal action by attorneys general from a number of conservative states, and that's sort of what forced their hand. Those states had already challenged a larger program that the Obama administration tried to put in place back in 2014 and had been successful. Sessions said DACA probably would have fallen to the same legal challenge, and that might have been led to sort of a disorderly unwinding of the program. So instead, the administration decided that an orderly wind down would be preferable to that.
And what does an orderly wind down mean for the Dreamers, for the DACA recipients, people who were brought to the country illegally as kids and maybe haven't spent much time at all in the country that they are from?
It's not going to mean anything right away. There's not going to be an immigration raid or any kind of immediate knock at the door. The DACA permits that they have remain valid, but there won't be any new applications accepted, and there's only a very limited window for DACA holders to renew those permits. So at some point, they will expire on sort of a rolling basis. And that means at that point they will be eligible for deportation. Now, Homeland Security Department says they still won't be a high priority for enforcement, but they'll certainly be at risk of deportation. And that means those long-term dreams will sort of be in limbo.
This is obviously a very controversial move by the administration. What is the line of reasoning that they're using to justify it?
Attorney General Sessions cast this as sort of a defense of the rule of law, a defense of the role of Congress to make immigration law, and not to let the executive sort of run roughshod over what lawmakers decide. And it is that. But make no mistake, Jeff Sessions is also a hardliner on immigration in general. And
right.
So it's not just the turf battle here, but it's also the substance disorder that he takes exception to. He talked about the DACA recipients as taking jobs from native-born Americans. And he even raised the specter that immigration brings crime and violence and the threat of terrorism.
So what's been the reaction so far? I know there are some Republican senators who have already come out and said this is not what they want.
We had House Speaker Paul Ryan, on the one hand, agree with the administration that DACA was an abuse of executive authority, but he also offered kind words for the DACA recipients. He called them young people who came to this country through no fault of their own, and for many, it's the only country they know, sort of echoing the words there of former President Obama. Ryan says it's his hope that both the House and the Senate will be able to find consensus on some sort of permanent legislative solution here that allows the Dreamers to stay.
But what are the chances of that, Scott? Given everything else that's going on right now in Washington, can Congress do what it hasn't done yet, which is to do something for these DACA recipients?
It's certainly not a slam dunk. We have seen a variety of lawmakers, including folks like Senator Orrin Hatch, come out in support of some sort of legislative DREAM Act. But Congress tried to pass a law like that in the waning days of 2010. It made it through the House, but was held up by a Republican filibuster in the Senate. And one of the loudest opponents to the DREAM Act at that time was then Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions.
Are we hearing from anybody on Capitol Hill so far who is cheering the decision by the White House to do this?
Yeah, I think you'll hear some hardliners, immigration hardliners on the Hill who will support the administration. And you'll certainly hear Republicans standing up for sort of the defense of congressional prerogative and their opportunity to set immigration policy, not have it taken over by the executive. But at the same time, some will say, okay, now it's time for us to do our job and impose some kind of patch here. That seems to be what President Trump is urging lawmakers to do. Whether they have the bandwidth to do it or not, we shall see.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley with the latest on today's announcement on DACA. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, let's check in on Irma. Florida Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency as Hurricane Irma strengthens in the Atlantic. The now Category 5 storm threatening the northern Caribbean islands and Florida is the strongest in the Atlantic in a decade. In Puerto Rico, there are predictions it could take months to restore electricity on the island if capacity is destroyed as expected. And of course, we're watching the advance of Irma while Houston's recovering from Harvey. Nerves are a little on edge. Jeff Huffman is the director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Jeff, we saw tweets from meteorologists last week about the awesome nature of Irma. Why? What are you seeing?
Well, Robin, it has plenty of potential to stay this strong for a long period of time. We began talking about it a week ago as it potentially being a long-lived major hurricane, and it has now reached Category 5 status. I really don't see anything, meteorologically speaking, that could cause significant weakening before it would possibly arrive to a landmass. So the bottom line is Irma's a major storm, and until it hits land, it will likely stay major category status.
Winds to 180 miles an hour, gusts up to 220 miles an hour. What might it hit?
Well, the track through the Greater Antilles or just north of there is going to be very precarious in the next few days. So it will likely have a direct impact on the British, U.S. and British Virgin Islands, will likely get close enough to Puerto Rico for significant impacts there. And then it's a bit questionable as we go out to day three, day four, day five. We're talking Thursday and Friday, how much influence the island of Hispaniola and the island of Cuba may have on the storm. Right now, the National Hurricane Center believes it'll move somewhere between the island of Cuba and the Bahamas, which obviously is bad because it will stay rather strong through its duration of the next 5 days.
Well, American Airlines canceled flights to St. Kitts and St. Martin for today and tomorrow, added additional flights for people to evacuate the islands and go to Miami. But who knows what might happen, you know, once they get there. But you talk about the winds. What about the rain? We know climate change doesn't cause hurricanes, but warm waters from climate change make hurricanes stronger. Researchers attributed the record rainfall from Harvey to that storm going back out to sea and hoovering up all that warm water. Do you expect Irma to get stronger in that way?
Well, I think it's a, you know, once we get to this type of storm, whether it's 180, 150, 160, 200, the wind impacts are going to be significant. The surge impacts could be significant. Harvey's rainfall was, of course, caused by the stalling of the storm. Right now, thankfully, we don't see it completely stalling, but it will slow down on its approach. I want to point out, Robin, also, you talked about the evacuations. This will be a big challenge for Florida. This is one of the most challenging type of scenarios Florida's emergency management has to endure. Or to plan for is a storm that might make a turn and move up the peninsula from its tip to its top. And that could cause a significant challenge for evacuees. We don't even know which side of the peninsula it might hit right now.
Well, we spoke with a forecaster yesterday who said it takes 3 days just to evacuate the Florida Keys because of the tiny road system there. So there's a state of emergency order. What does that mean? How does that intersect with evacuations? What's going on?
Well, it puts in place, well, first of all, it just sets a precedent for everyone to start paying attention and listening and realize. I mean, we even here where I work from in Gainesville, in inland parts of North Florida, people know it's coming. I mean, store shelves are starting to empty. So I think that proactive action that the governor took just sets in motion all the plans, the plan that our emergency managers work for years to come up with in case this would happen. So that is all in motion. I've not heard of an official evacuation order just yet, but I do believe that those will start coming out by midweek. And I encourage all those listening in Florida and surrounding areas to listen to authorities. We don't need We don't need extra chaos and panic right now. We need to stay calm and listen to our authorities. They have been working for years on a plan for this type of scenario. You know, Hurricane Donna is an example of a track this may take, and that's a storm that our emergency managers use to plan for.
And remind us, where did Donna hit? Remind us.
Well, Donna was similar. Donna, you know, approached South Florida. And then it was very unsure which side of the peninsula it was going to make the turn to the north. Mm-hmm. And that poses a great challenge to the evacuation story, because which coastline, which side of the peninsula do you evacuate first or second? And, you know, everyone has to go north. You can't go east or west in this type of situation. You have to go north. And so if people are talking about Donna, remember, I actually know firsthand that that's a storm that our emergency managers in our state use to prepare for, because right. It does represent one of the worst case scenarios right. for an evacuation.
Well, you also had Andrew. I mean, just fingers crossed for not just Florida, but Cuba, as we see pictures now of this storm Irma just bearing down. Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, with our update on Hurricane Irma, Category 5. Jeff, thank you.
You got it.
It has been less than a month since the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that turned deadly when a car crashed into a crowd of protesters, killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer and injuring nearly two dozen others. The incident started a national conversation about racism, but also anti-Semitism. Many of the rally participants were neo-Nazis, which brought to mind a conversation we had earlier this year about a question some comedians are asking: is it too soon to joke about the Holocaust? A new documentary by director Fern Perlstein looks at that with perspectives from comedian Gilbert Gottfried and others, as well as Holocaust survivors. I spoke with Perlstein and Gottfried in March and asked Gottfried why he wanted to do the film.
I had nothing else to do that day. It was something that just seemed like a good fit, because I'm constantly getting in trouble for stuff I joke about. And, you know, people are always, like, accusing me of, like, oh, that's, you can't joke about this topic or that topic, or it's too soon. You have to wait this amount of time, and then it makes it okay. So I was ready to talk about it.
Because you think that that's unfair, that you should be able to make those jokes?
I think it's silly that such a big uproar can happen over a joke. Like, I remember when I got in trouble with the whole tsunami business, they were writing it up as, and Gilbert Gottfried's tasteless comments and remarks, and none of them were calling them jokes. Because when you say joke, the word joke, you go, yeah, okay, he's a comedian, he makes jokes.
But tasteless comments makes it sound like it's a serious comment. It's not a joke.
Yeah. It sounds like I'm really making a statement, you know, like bad things that happen I'm in favor of.
Well, where do you come down on joking about the Holocaust?
Yeah, well, it's a funny thing. I feel the same way about that. Like, I've made jokes about the Holocaust, tsunami, 9/11. I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, I'm as hypocritical as anybody, because when there was the big uproar about Mel Gibson, they said, you know, Mel Gibson was driving drunk, and they arrested him, and he asked the policewoman if she was a Jew, and she said yes, and he said, "You Jews caused all the wars in the world." And then he called her some obscene sexual remark. And news came out that he slapped his wife while she was holding their child. And he said to his wife he wants a group of African-Americans, although he didn't use that term, to rape her. And he would hit her over the head with a shovel and bury her in the Rose Garden. And when all that was said and done, all I could think was, wait a minute. What did he say about the Jews?
Well, Fern Perlstein, you know, we hear from comedians in this documentary, but we also hear from Holocaust survivors very prominently, in particular a woman named Renee Firestone, who lost family members in the camps. At one point, she describes being examined by the infamous doctor of Auschwitz, Joseph Mengele. Let's listen to a little bit of the film.
If you survive this war, he says, you better have your tonsils removed. You have big tonsils. So, you know, at that time, I was thinking, is he insane? I mean, tomorrow I may die. I'm worried about my tonsils. But when I came back, when I survived and came back and I thought about it, what he said, it was funny.
So, you know, throughout the film, we hear details of Renee's life, and we also see her watching comedians joke about the Holocaust. What were you trying to do by telling her story as part of this film?
Well, the thing that made me want to make this film is when I found out that there was some humor in the camps, that in that darkest of dark, people could still find humor there. And I wanted that personal story. I also wanted to see it through her eyes. I know that when I, you know, in the film, you see her looking at comedians through doing their stuff on YouTube, some Holocaust jokes. And I wanted that feeling of, well, you know, it's not a black and white issue. Is it okay or not okay? Well, it depends. You know, there's time, context, who's your audience, who's the person making the joke. There's so many factors. And I know, for instance, when she's watching Sarah Silverman do stuff from Jesus's Magic, which is a show I saw in the earliest of days, you know, on a, you know, little black box theater with a lot of people my age watching it in the dark where you're not being held accountable. It was hilarious. But then when I was filming her and the cameras on her face, hearing those same lines delivered, it was uncomfortable. Yeah. It was different.
What did that tell you, that she didn't find it funny after she's been talking throughout the film about how she does want to laugh at stuff like that?
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? It's not a black and white issue. And also, she's 92. Well, at least she is now. She was probably a couple years younger then. But, you know, there's definitely a generation gap. But at the same time, just because she has a great sense of humor and a great spirit and chooses to laugh than to cry, she still may not find it funny when Sarah Silverman tells a joke about her grandmother having the tattoo from the camp say bedazzled instead of numbers. But she often says, you know, I don't think it's funny. I'm not offended.
Right, right. She's willing to let people tell those jokes. It's just she doesn't find them funny personally.
Right.
Let's listen to another clip from this film because you've got Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks talking about this. Let's listen.
Do you have a Holocaust joke? Do you have a Holocaust joke?
Gee, I don't know any Holocaust. Do you know any Holocaust jokes?
No. I can't go there. I can't. I personally, who have done a musical called The Inquisition, you know, with Jews floating around and being dunked in water and tortured, I cannot go there.
So I was surprised to hear that, Gilbert Gottfried, that Mel Brooks says that he can't go there when this is the guy who did Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah, it's very odd to hear him say that because he certainly doesn't hold back.
You know, he it's for him, it's, you know, you could joke about the perpetrators, but you can't joke about the victims. And he feels very strongly about it.
Hmm. So that's the distinction for him, is he's making a joke about Hitler, not the victims.
Yeah. But, you know, even early on, I started every interview with the same set of questions. And then I'd individually research that person and add a whole bunch of personal stuff to it. But every interview I started with, do you have a Holocaust joke? Because I wanted to sort of break the ice. And I started to notice this pattern that, like, after the fifth interview, I noticed everyone would say, well, I don't have a Holocaust joke, but I do have a Nazi joke.
Mm, interesting.
So then I would start the interviews with, well, I used to say, do you have a Nazi Holocaust joke? And then I tell them the story and I say, well, which do you have? Because it became such a thing. So I think even if people don't make as much of a distinction in that line, it's still ingrained in there. And for me, I didn't make a distinction. And when I brought that up and told that story to Gilbert in the interview, he said, yeah, because the Nazis had nothing to do with the Holocaust.
Well, they've been blamed unfairly over the years.
Right.
As was Hitler. Maybe he was a little overzealous.
Well, I want to go to something that you say in the film. When you hear the phrase tragedy plus time equals comedy, your response is, why wait?
Yeah, I never understood it. Like, I don't know where there's an office who specializes in it and looks on their computer and goes, okay, August 2nd, you'll be able to say that joke and it won't be bad taste anymore. I say jokes right when the tragedy's occurring, and people say, oh, that's so bad taste. To me, it's worse taste when you're saying it at a time when you're saying, well, it's acceptable now. Like, you could do jokes about the Titanic now.
Right.
And it's like, you won't get in trouble. But it's basically so when you wait, you're saying, hey, all those people on the Titanic, they're dead. And by now, their grandkids are dead. You know, the hell with them. I'll make a joke. And that's good taste.
Yeah, yeah.
At least with me. I do it when it happens. And part of what's funny is the shock value of, oh, you're not supposed to say that. And so you're acknowledging it as a tragedy.
I remember that right after 9/11, George Carlin was supposed to have a comedy special called I Kind of Like It When a Lot of People Die.
Which oh, yes.
they ended up pulling just in time. Well, Gilbert Gottfried and Fern Perlstein of the film The Last Laugh. It's really interesting to see both comedians and Holocaust survivors talk about joking about the Holocaust. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
And Gilbert Gottfried, I have to say, and I'm sure that of all the films you've done, this is not the one that everybody points to, but thank you for Problem Child, which had me laughing for many years and still to this day.
That was a surprise hit. No one expected that one.
And let's get response now to the Trump administration's announcement today, delivered by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, that DACA, the Obama executive orders that defer deportation for so-called dreamers brought to the U.S. illegally as children before 2007, has been rescinded. Attorney General Sessions called it unconstitutional.
The compassionate thing to do is end the lawlessness, enforce our laws, and if Congress chooses to make changes to those laws, to do so through the process set forth by our founders.
And Sessions gave Congress 6 months to come up with a legislative alternative. Thaís Marquez was five when she was brought to the U.S. from Brazil. She's an organizer for Movimiento Cosecha, an advocacy group for undocumented immigrants. She's outside Trump Tower with protesters. Thaís, what'd you think when you heard rescinded?
Well, when I heard it, I was with a lot of folks. And I thought that, you know, we've been going through the motions, but I wouldn't steal anything. But I immediately just felt like my heart sank to my stomach. And it was just a very sad moment. A lot of people were crying. We just feel a real sense of loss for not just DACA as, you know, like a paper or a work permit, but for everything that DACA has given the 800,000 young undocumented immigrants in this country.
Talk about that, because in order to qualify, you have to either be in school or in the military. You can have criminal records. It gives you a work permit. Tell us more about what it gave you and what you fear you might lose.
I received DACA when I was 18 years old, and I was able to get a job that paid me a living wage. And immediately I became the highest earner in my household. My mom's a housekeeper and my dad cleans parking lots at night. And even though they work really hard, they don't really get paid very well. Every month was just a question about whether we were going to make ends meet. But when I got a job that was a living wage, I was able to really support my family. And for the first time, we were financially stable. And I know that this is a story that many young undocumented immigrants have, where they provide for their family members or they provide for the children that we have. Mm. And so I think this is going to be a huge crisis in immigrant communities where primary financial supports are going to be lost and hundreds of thousands of people are going to be forced to leave school.
Well, by some estimates, 1,400 people a day will lose jobs when this happens. But if Congress doesn't come up with a solution and DACA expires, you've also had to come forward and register every 2 years. Are you worried that, I mean, losing a job and losing the income is one thing. Do you think you'll be deported?
It's really unsure. I mean, we voluntarily gave all of our information, and I'm unsure of what they're going to do with that. I think that there's a real fear in people's minds that I'm going to use that information to come after undocumented folks And I come from a mixed status family, and so there is a fear that I'll be removed from my family, and I don't know Brazil. I haven't been there in 17 years. So not only would I lose my entire life here, I would also be separated from my family.
That's Thais Marquez, a DACA recipient, responding to the news today that the program has been rescinded. She and others from the immigration advocacy group Movimiento Cosecha are protesting outside Trump Tower. Thais, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Trade negotiators have been meeting for the past few days in Mexico for a second round of talks on renegotiating NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The Trump administration has been pushing for tighter labor standards, but Mexican negotiators have resisted those demands. The country's low wages and worker union rules have made it easy to attract American companies across the border. Meanwhile, last week, the Trump administration selected four contractors to build prototypes of a border wall, which President Trump has said Mexico will pay for. Mexico has said it won't. How is all this affecting U.S.-Mexico relations? Joining us now by Skype from Mexico City is Carlos Puig, who is the host of a news program on Milenio TV and a columnist for Milenio Diario. Carlos, welcome back.
Hello, how are you doing? Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back. And how is Mexico viewing this renegotiation of NAFTA?
Well, lately it's getting more difficult because, as you know, President Trump has been again and again, I think it was three times in the last couple of weeks, saying that he really didn't want to renegotiate NAFTA. He would have preferred to just get out of NAFTA, what he calls the worst trade deal ever negotiated. So the first thing the foreign minister did, he actually said, okay, we are not negotiating this deal through social media. We are not going to do that. But then when President Trump said it again, then clearly what the foreign minister said is, if these threats continue, if we're not going to be in that table negotiating. So things are tough because you cannot be in a table negotiating a deal that the other side doesn't want to be in. It's like the Mayweather fight, this thing. No, it's like the UFC against boxing. Difficult to have something good there, no? Because you're playing two different games. And the idea, because of President Trump's speeches, is that he doesn't want the deal. So I think it's going to be quite a difficult time.
Well, would Mexico prefer to just leave NAFTA as is? I mean, is it more beneficial the way that it is right now versus any change that could take place?
Well, it depends on the changes. I think the changes that the U.S. government has put on the table, the ones that are in the official document after consultation with Congress and businesses, I think Mexico doesn't want to be in a treaty that reflects that document. I think Mexico is happy right now. It would love to have some things in NAFTA retouched, renegotiated, something, but not in the sense of what President Trump said on the campaign, not what the document of what they want, what he wants from the trade deal state. So I think Mexico is quite in a difficult situation right now.
There is a presidential election coming up in Mexico next year. Do you think that it's possible that Mexico could back out of these NAFTA talks altogether just because politically it's too difficult to sign a new agreement right before an election?
I think Mexico would love to end this renegotiation right now, but I think they can't because they know that if they get up from the table right now, I think President Trump, well, I know, I think he has said it, President Trump will pull the plug on NAFTA, on all NAFTA, and that wouldn't be good for the country. I think Mexico wants to have a very small and effective renegotiation that ends before the electoral process starts in Mexico, which is, let's say, January. And I think that's quite difficult.
What about the issue of the border wall? As you know, President Trump has recently tweeted again about the wall, saying that Mexico is going to pay for it through reimbursement / other. What does that mean to you when you hear that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think everybody asks, what does that mean? I think what he means is things like trade. Let's say they build the wall, and it has a price, and everybody knows how much it costs. I think what he's going to argue to his base later on, because of the renegotiation, is, hey, you know how I got that money? Look at the trade deficit before. Look at the trade deficit now. So I got that money. I think that's the way he's going to sell it to his base. Of course, that's not true. That's a lie. I mean, trade deficits and reimbursement. Or he's going to, for example, set a new price for visas. And actually, Mexico is one of the biggest consumers of U.S. visas in the world. So if you get $100 for every single visa that a Mexican gets in a consulate, maybe he can make that argument. It's very, very difficult to me to understand how. I think trade has a lot to do with that.
But how does it feel in Mexico now? Because I know that when I was down there, people were really upset that he kept talking about Mexico paying for the wall. What's it doing to relations between the two countries?
Well, I think it's very bad for the relationship of the two countries, for the image of Donald Trump in Mexico. I think we're in the worst moment of the relationships in a long, 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 long time. At the same time, he has been saying it for so long. The Mexican government has been saying for so long, no, we're not going to pay. That, I mean, it becomes kind of a joke now, no, about you're going to pay. No, I'm not going to pay. No, you're going to pay. When it's obvious that the Mexican government will never, no Mexican government will never sign a check for that wall.
That's Carlos Puig, who is host of a news program on Milenio TV and a columnist for Milenio Diario, joining us from Mexico City. Carlos, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Well, renegotiating NAFTA could likely have a big impact on American manufacturing. But the strength of the U.S. economy is right now lifting manufacturing jobs. The Commerce Department did say today that orders at U.S. factories fell off in July because of a decline in aircraft orders. But overall, manufacturing has been having a good run. Factories added 36,000 jobs just last month. In fact, employers say they can't find workers. The Labor Department says the country has more than 6 million jobs open, and yet the labor force participation rate remains low. So what can employers do to persuade more potential workers to get off the bench? NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax joins us from Washington. And Marilyn, the latest jobs report released on Friday showed the unemployment rate basically steady, 4.4%, very low. Mm-hmm. And yet we're still not seeing a surge in people seeking work with that all those jobs. What's the problem?
Well, in general, here's one thing that's happening. A lot of baby boomers, that's about 75 million people or so, are retiring. They're in their mid-50s to their 70s, so people are aging out of the workforce. And when they step out of the workforce, somebody has to come in behind them, but the country's becoming a little less welcoming to immigrants. So that's kind of what this whole DACA discussion is about. You know, there are something like 800,000 young people in this country who are covered by that. If that program unwinds, maybe they can't be in the workforce. So there's an issue of just not enough warm bodies. But there's also something else, which is that a lot of people just don't feel that jobs pay enough to be worth coming to work. So, you know, you might live in West Virginia and you need a job and you hear there's jobs galore in Seattle, but is it worth it to move there to work in a restaurant? Does it pay enough? And a lot of people conclude, no, it doesn't.
Well, then that's what analysts say is one of the biggest differences now, is that people don't get up en masse and move to where jobs are. We've also heard about the skills gap. What's that?
Well, that's another thing that is true for a lot of places. They want people with advanced skills for technology jobs, healthcare, and even in factories, it's true. I mean, the idea of getting a job in a factory where you just push a wheelbarrow, that's not so much anymore. You know, they want you to work with robots and computers. So there is a skills gap that is holding back a lot of hiring.
Okay, so employers obviously can raise pay to make it worth it for people to relocate, but what else can they do?
Well, there are other things that, you know, a lot of people who say, you want more workers, how about giving them more flexibility, allow them to telecommute more, maybe shift their hours, also make the workplace even friendlier to people with disabilities, and stop discriminating against people based on age. A lot of times people just don't even look at job applicants who are over 60, and that's, you know, maybe keeping a lot of people out of a labor pool. And there's job training. You know, companies don't want to spend money on training, but hey, you don't have enough workers. Spend the money. So you have to create more apprenticeships for young people, work with community colleges, even offer financial assistance to help people upgrade their skills.
Marilyn Giewax, giving advice to America's factories. She's NPR's senior business editor. Marilyn, thanks as always.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.
Thousands of evacuees are sheltering in North Texas after being displaced by Hurricane Harvey. Courtney Collins of KERA stopped by one Dallas shelter where some volunteers have been trying to bring a bit of fun to a tough situation.
On a sweltering Texas afternoon, Lewis Holweg decided to sweeten the deal at the Walnut Hill Recreation Center.
So I have an ice cream truck out here for a few hours. That's a little thing.
It wasn't such a little thing to the swarm of kids enjoying the treats. The truck was parked outside the hurricane shelter for hours. There was no cap on the fun. Think open bar with popsicles. Diamond Compton is a 9-year-old from Port Arthur.
It's hot. And you gotta want something to cool you off.
Diamond and her little brother, Josiah Anderson, have been back for seconds and thirds and may have lost count.
More than one. More than 10, actually. That I had three more than six.
That's just the reaction Lewis Holweg was hoping for. It's the very reason Holweg, a psychologist in the neighborhood, up and decided to hire an ice cream truck off the internet and send it to a hurricane shelter.
Well, I walked in here and I watched, and people are dislocated, they're lonely, there's nothing to do in there. I mean, people are trying, but what do you do all day? Well, one thing you can do is eat a little ice cream in the afternoon.
And the ice cream is just one example. Volunteers handed out McDonald's gift cards that afternoon, and the Dallas Zoo sent over a sheaf of free tickets. SMU comped evacuees to its football home opener over the weekend. The Nasher Sculpture Center will welcome evacuees at no charge until the last shelter in town shuts down. Diamond and Josiah's mom, Daphne Griffin, can't get over it.
We're thinking about staying in Dallas because of the community. They come together, and we've never seen nothing like that before.
The volunteers say they know being away from home and not knowing what comes next is tough. For the kids here, double-fisting sour swirl and cotton candy ice cream bars makes the ordeal a bit sweeter. For Here and Now, I'm Courtney Collins in Dallas.
And this update, the Walnut Hill shelter has closed. Those evacuees have been moved to the Dallas Convention Center. Well, this week, the House of Representatives is scheduled to address regulations for self-driving cars. For more on that, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics at Recode. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And tell us about this bill called the Self-Drive Act. What would it do?
Yeah, it's called the Self-Drive Act. And, you know, in Washington, D.C. right now, there really isn't a whole lot that unites Democrats and Republicans these days. But both parties do seem to agree that there's great need to put more self-driving cars on U.S. roads. They think it's cool technology. They think it can reduce traffic congestion. And they believe it can save lives given the high number of highway fatalities there are with humans at the wheel. So the piece of legislation that's up for debate and ultimately a vote on Wednesday would put into motion a way for companies like Uber and Google and Ford and others to start testing as many as 100,000 experimental vehicles over the period of about 3 or 4 years. It's really the first statement from Congress on self-driving cars that we've seen, and it's teed up now for the Senate as well.
And would it override state rules on self-driving cars?
Yes and no. I mean, the way that it works in Washington, D.C. right now is that the U.S. government handles the way the cars are made, some of the federal safety standards, things that govern seatbelts and steering wheels and so forth. So under this bill, it just extends that to self-driving cars. States can't regulate the guts of the car, but they can continue to regulate things like licensing and, you know, what cars can and can't do on local roads.
So you mentioned the Senate. What are the chances of something like this making it through Congress?
Well, the Senate is where a lot of good ideas go to die. It's a little bit slower than the House, but lawmakers there have been working for quite some time to put together a bipartisan compromise on self-driving cars. But their bill hasn't even gotten to a hearing because of some intense lobbying by another force. That's local unions like the Teamsters, which have concerns about self-driving trucks and what that technology would mean for truck drivers around the country and how they would make ends meet.
What are the regulations right now for self-driving cars around the country? Or is it just a mixed bag depending on where you are?
Yeah, it's a bit of a patchwork. Each state sort of has its own approach to self-driving cars and how they can be tested and how they can be used. And the federal government really hasn't issued very much of an approach at all. There are just some voluntary guidelines that were put into place at the very end of the Obama administration. So this legislation in the House would really start a process within the U.S. government to get self-driving cars on U.S. roads over the course of the next couple of years. But it won't be easy. A number of those government positions and transportation policy issues, things that deal with self-driving cars, remain unfilled right now.
And again, chances that this will actually make it through Congress and get signed by the president?
Well, it'll certainly make it through the House. When the bill went through the committee, it was voted out 54 to nothing. It's rare that a piece of legislation gets that sort of bipartisan support. Whether it can get through the Senate, though, is another matter entirely, because we're at a moment where there's a lot on Congress's plate, from the budget to the hurricane, to deal with.
That's Tony Rahm, Senior Editor of Policy and Politics at Recode. Tony, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.